Modern Pharisees. All this stuff about Pharisees speaks pretty strongly to me because I grew up with it and lived it. Of course, we heard, read aloud at church each week, every single word that Jesus is recorded saying to and about Pharisees. And of course, we applied every word to other Christians, and in particular, to people who said one thing and did another, rather than to religious play actors, rather than to us, the gathered saints, to Catholics, rather than meeting folks, to the televangelists who had the sex scandals. Not to our laboring brothers and the lives we expected them to live. Hypocrites, we thought, were people who couldn't deliver on their promises of superior self-control and piety. Not like our guys could. You didn't see our leaders being accused of taking money they shouldn't have or of sexual impropriety. Well, you did, but we weren't supposed to talk about that. Tell it not in Gath, of course. What was the good in tearing down the Lord's people? We all fail. There's no perfect group of Christians. Don't dwell on it. Move on. Nothing to see here. Get over yourself. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Tell the weeping woman she should be quiet. And we looked down on people who weren't as strict as we were. On people one could see were clearly less legalistic than we were. Less hardcore. Who couldn't keep the rules. Who didn't even have very many rules. Who had less control. Less willpower. Fewer ambitious resolutions and vows. And a lot of us, it must be said, were pretty fake, performers under masks. I increasingly felt how fake I was. I was barely a person, let alone a Christian. God was repeatedly putting this before me, waiting for me to take it a bit more seriously. But I had always been taught that being a good testimony or sending a good message justified doing those fake things. It turned out that doing things for show is a very bad testimony. And our life decisions really were being made solely on how things might look. We really fussed over how Christians shouldn't talk and what kinds of clothes they shouldn't wear, what they shouldn't laugh at, and what shouldn't give them any joy whatsoever. But there was no understanding of virtue in all of that. No health, no growth, no excellence, no worth, no authenticity, no simplicity. It was subtractive rather than about adding good stuff, conforming to a church image rather than being transformed in an inner way by Christ. It was only lifestyle deep rather than something that started at the root of us, something we had to concoct and simulate rather than Christ working among us. And I was entirely a creature of that. When I was a teenager, one June, I signed an electric bass guitar out of the music room at school. So, I had a new instrument to try out all summer long. During the summer, I would not have band practice or school. It would be nothing but meetings. Way too much time. So, an electric bass guitar. I felt like I'd been given a Ferrari when I got to take this instrument home for free. I felt a bit guilty because it looked cool, but I did it anyway. And that kind of thing was very good for me, in a time when not much in my life was terribly happy. And I was happily plugging it in and trying it out, and my mother stood looking at me for a minute, troubled, and then said pensively, "Imagine if Mrs. Hayhoe could see you right now." And right away, I felt the shame. On some level, I knew that what had just happened right there was pretty messed up, and that neither my mother nor I had created the messed up situation, but were pawns in it. But I still felt that cold stab of shame. It still took the heart out of me. It still mostly ruined playing the bass that summer. Not that I stopped. And my mother, for her part, was fearing my loss of church status and what might be done to me. A sensible fear, it turned out. When asked about the need to keep up a godly appearance and being conscious of everyone's eyes being on one, Melody writes that she was aware of it.
"Always, this was always emphasized to us. Image was everything, and what will people think was a constant refrain."
Mary writes that growing up, she was always
supremely and constantly aware that everyone, both in and out of the meeting, were watching to see how godly or worldly I was being. I felt non-meeting people constantly judging how non-like them I was, and meeting people holding up yardsticks to every single action, haircut, word, piece of clothing, friendship, trip destination, etc. Everything was judged.
Life was like that for many of us, even for simple things like going to our first movie in a movie theater or buying our first alcoholic drink. Mary writes,
I went to the movies and felt chagrined, as Gremlins 2 was a really bad movie. Just not well done, I mean. I felt cheated, like it was supposed to be this wonderful experience, and the fact that the movie sucked didn't help make it the hoped-for first. It did help to get the first over with, though, which I was glad for. Then buying wine, which I knew nothing about, and so chose Mogan David for the first bottle, as it was what I saw used at meeting. Both experiences made me feel stupid, which I hated. Master of nothing, just a newbie who had no taste, no teacher, and no help in figuring out what was good and what wasn't worth it. Took non-meeting friends to help school me in all that, at least in my 20s.
Anne, whose parents were missionaries, mentions it being more difficult in the third world countries where her parents worked to seem godly.
It was worse in third world countries where my parents were missionaries. I had people mention that certain clothes weren't appropriate. In the U.S., we were always well within the norms of godly compared to others. I guess Mom and Dad raised me with enough self-consciousness that I wasn't doing anything that made me look worldly. We had an electric keyboard that we hid under the bed so the locals wouldn't see it. Mom wanted to be able to play piano, and we took lessons. The reason we hid it is that, this is how my dad explained it, the locals associated musical instruments with parties and drinking. So it was best not to stumble them by revealing that we enjoyed music.
Joy was seen as something that could trip up new Christians. When I went to my first movie at 21, I drove an hour away so no one would see that particular first, even though I knew that my going to see Star Trek VI was a good thing that God had no problem with at all. We'd talked about it for an embarrassing amount of time for months in advance. By that point in time, I was no longer afraid that God would make me smash my car if I drove it to Star Trek VI. That superstitious fear had eventually dried up and died off very slowly. But I was afraid my close brethren, friends, and relatives would draw away from me after expressing concerns at my worldliness and lack of legalism, and that I would soon be kicked out of the church, banned globally from social events and taking communion, cut out of the dating pool entirely. And all of that happened, of course. But I can't say it all started with going to see Star Trek VI and not hiding it, because that isn't true. In reality, by the time I was 21 and had gone and seen Kirk and Spock, all of that Pharisee-style ecclesiastical vengeance was more or less a foregone conclusion and had already started happening. Even my cousins were drawing away from me in disapproval when I no longer needed to read novelizations to find out the plot of movies just hitting the theaters, when I didn't need to wait until the movies were available to rent, when I'd clearly been to a movie theater. I had brethren friends who were getting the same treatment too. Because part of being a Pharisee is assuming that you are normal and that it's everyone else who is odd. That you do God service to try to nudge others towards being, thinking, feeling, and acting more like you do. That it's okay to continually comment on their differences to you. It involves not seeing what cataclysmic damage simply doing this little thing repeatedly can do to groups, relationships, and people's personal identities, to their very souls. But next, the worst part. Ecclesiastical divorce hurts kids. We had our first local church division in 1991, and we kept far more than our fair share of Pharisees in that ugly, prolonged church divorce. And we lost the lion's share of the teens, 20-somethings and 30-somethings, most of the middle-aged people too, especially if they had children. Because we wouldn't so much as let people use a 20th century translation of the Bible without making snarky comments. They couldn't add hymns to our hymn book, which had last been updated traditional hymns with certain verses excised over a century previous. They couldn't pray without using thee and thou, and not get lectures about that either. We wouldn't give them anything. We smothered them with concerns and punished any and all lapses in their legalistic duties. If they were really getting into the Bible because of a modern translation? If they discovered some modern hymns that absolutely spoke their heart and wanted to sing them at meeting? We sneered, or showed concern at that, instead of joy, just as if we didn't love them at all. We dropped them several rungs down on our brethren status meter, warned against everything they wanted to do, counseled, never following their hearts, but helping maintain the status quo instead. In the winter of 1989, I attended Barakel Winter Youth Camp. At this camp, I met literally hundreds of Tunbridge Wells young people. The TWs managed to lose pretty much everyone that I met there, literally in the next couple of years, apart from those who'd married Hayhoes, were Hayhoes already, or both. I miss those people. I think it's dumb that we don't talk anymore. But we expected them to put up with absolutely anything we did at meeting and attend regularly, even if they got nothing much out of it personally, because that was what it meant to be a Christian, walking properly. And having decimated our groups with the huge, stupid division, we were soon gearing up to have another one. Once the glow of the first one fully wore off, we were spoiling for it. And all through the 90s, young people not only kept leaving our churches, but they kept on dying too. Car wrecks, suicide, accidents, murder, a truly troubling amount of that kind of thing. And there was a spate of near drownings and other lucky escapes too. It was almost like growing up in that toxic screw you if you won't go along with what's done spiritual environment was hurting people. Like young folks were being eaten by things. For a long stretch there, leading right up to the 2003 division, we were losing a young brethren person every single year. A couple years, it was more than one. When my friend Doug, not yet 30, shot himself 14 years ago today, one of my first thoughts was, when is this ever going to end? And there were sensible voices droning on through all of this young death, of course. They looked at the young people and said things like, well, she dated quite a few boys, or I heard he was into drinking alcohol, or her attendance was getting pretty spotty, or he was dressing pretty worldly. And then they said something that I think could not be more Pharisee. The Lord is speaking. And there'd be that ominous pause at the end, and a refusal to admit what was really being said. God killed that girl. For going to the movies and dating a Pentecostal fellow. God killed that boy. As a warning, for going to NHL games and drinking the occasional beer. And he'd done it because he wanted us all to know how very unhappy he was with our lapses in legalism. Oh, be careful, little mouths, what you drink. Rabbi, who drank, this corpse or his parents? The Lord is speaking. I think that when you try to escape a Pharisee Christian lifestyle, heart focus, and mindset, there are those things that want to eat you. Things which are guarding the threshold of Pharisee land, put there as watchdogs to keep everyone in. I think there are seven things worse than the first thing that the Pharisee lifestyle promised to rid you of, waiting there drooling. Things from which the Pharisees who raised you are now claiming they shrug can no longer protect you given your life choices. And I think when older people talk about death and injury as predictable, sensible, loving, divine responses to young people having a beer at a hockey game or going to a rock concert, they are almost giving permission to calamity. They are taking a side with the things, blaming the victims, saying they were asking for it going there at night, dressed like that. Sad, of course, but not surprising. As I said, we were, many of us, living pretty fake, for-show lives, filled with superstitious prohibitions and an almost total focus upon lifestyle, pastimes, dress, and outer appearance. Lives characterized by shame, fear, and obligation. We weren't seen at church events without our masks on, and we had to show up at those events if we wanted to keep our seats. We had no Christian liberty because we'd been burdened with the yoke of not letting our side down by ever failing to look like a peculiar people who abstained from certain things, much like Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Sikhs, and Muslim fundamentalists do. We were demonstrably more than willing in all the unceasing political infighting to cut our own brothers loose if they refused to see things our way. We silenced Bible teachers who didn't take a hard stance against alcohol, modern translations, and live entertainment. And we taught people that their feelings weren't part of them, but rather self-indulgent things to carefully not have. Things to not disrupt the proceedings or bother others with. People were, or were meant to be anyway, machines of self-control. Non-selves. For us, self-control didn't mean don't let yourself go too far, but rather don't let yourself out at all. Keep that sick person locked away until glory. Eventually, we got to the point where we were lucky to have anyone under 60 years old left in most of our assemblies. But there were some of us, despite everything, and some of us had a pretty horrible, empty future mapped out for us from that point on. Then each year, what would happen as we geared up for the upcoming sequel to the previous division, with all of the rumblings and boycotted Bible conferences that went along with that, was that suddenly another young person would die. What's troubling is how much these deaths utterly validated some very Pharisaical people's very Pharisaical view of exactly how it was that God dealt with Christians. The Lord was speaking. And as we well knew, he mainly spoke through calamity and death to warn about people whose legalism was slipping, whose feelings were showing, who dared need more than we were willing to feed them. Dan Spence spoke out against accused sexual molesters among us. So when he got cancer of the tongue and had to have it removed and then eventually died, people said the Lord was speaking to him for accusing the saints. I was doing bad things, like listening to Pink Floyd's Animals album.
You dumb old hag, ha ha, she brought you on. You radiate cold shafts of broken glass. With a quick grin, you like the feel of steel, you hot stuff with a hat pin, a good bomb with a handgun, you're nearly alive, you're nearly alive, but you're really a crime.
To get myself out to meeting, so as not to lose my seat there, no matter how I felt inside about it. It was all about God, wasn't it, and how he loved us? Eventually, I got so I just couldn't look at the situation with Pharisee eyes anymore, and I started to see the endlessly obsessive, predatory machinations of things all around. We weren't living human, let alone Christian lives. And still, young people died.